The Brendan O'Connor Show on RTE Radio 1 with All Care Pharmacy. Expertise on vitamins and supplements to help build immunity at All Care Community Pharmacies across Ireland. The Brendan O'Connor Show on RTE Radio 1 with All Care Pharmacy. Expertise on vitamins and supplements to help build immunity at All Care Community Pharmacies across Ireland.
Good morning. You're very welcome to the show. I want to start today with an apology for something that happened on the show yesterday. I might have suggested yesterday that Joe Biden was maybe enlivened by his visit to Europe and to Poland. And I might have suggested that if he was an elderly relative, you would have been saying, well, he had a good day yesterday now. And I said that he was speaking kind of fluidly for him and everything else. I obviously take all that back today. And if he was an elderly relative, you'd be saying he did not have a good day yesterday. And it's on the front of a lot of the English papers, on the front of the Sunday Times as well. White House forced to retract new Biden blunder on Russia. And you heard there on the news, America are still trying to reassure everybody that they do not have a policy of taking Vladimir Putin out and regime change in Russia. COVID is back on our front pages as well, though. The Sunday Times, Irish curbs on COVID, second softest in the world. Only Mongolia are more relaxed than we are about the COVID at this stage. The Sunday Independent has a COVID-y lead as well. Donnelly and Houlihan clash on COVID body as cases spiral. So it seems the reason that we don't have a replacement for Neffet yet is because Dr. Houlihan wrote a letter on February 17th suggesting who he felt should be on the new body, but the Minister for Health disagrees. The Business Post is leading with construction firms threatened to down tools on housing and road schemes. Basically, a lot of construction firms are on fixed costs to do big public jobs, and they're saying that hyperinflation now means that they will go, some of them saying they'll go broke if they do those jobs at those prices. One contractor on a public project is at risk of losing 16 million due to rising prices. The off lead on the Business Post: tent camps likely to be needed within weeks amid surge in Ukrainian refugees, and there seems to be one already at an emergency tented facility at Gormanstown in County Meath. The Mail and The Sun and the Mirror are all leading on that very sad story in Carrigaline and Cork, and the stabbing dead of Shane Murphy, and his father Patrick Wishy Murphy seems to be in quite a serious condition in hospital as well. And the Sunday World has some Kinahan cartel wives on the front. Okay, we'll crack on our panel today. Professor Lisa Ryan is an energy economist and a professor at the School of Economics in University College Dublin. Paul Hosford is political correspondent with the Irish Examiner. Professor Cliona Ní Chealaigh is a specialist in inclusion health and infectious diseases at St James's Hospital and also of Trinity College Dublin. And Bobby McDonough is a former Irish ambassador to the UK and the EU. Good morning, everyone.
Morning.
Now, Cliona, I wasn't expecting to be seeing you again so soon, but here we are. On the front of the that story on the front of the Sunday Times about our relaxed approach, they quote Gerald Barry, who's a virologist from UCD. He tweeted on Friday, "The policy is clearly to let the virus move through the population on the assumption that most won't end up in hospital." Is that where we're at, do you think?
I think that's pretty accurate.
Let it rip.
Well, I don't like that word rip, but let it spread. Yeah. It seems to really be where the policy is. I mean, if you look, we're not doing anything about our indoor spaces. People have stopped wearing masks a lot from what I can see. So, yes, we can expect further spread. We're lucky the current variant is much milder. Most people are vaccinated, so not getting severely unwell. But there's a lot of virus around. So I'm just going to reiterate, if you don't want to get it, wear a mask, because it's COVID soup out there.
Yeah, it really is, isn't it? Mm. I'd say I think most people's anecdotal experiences, this is the most there's ever been.
Oh, and the numbers are highest. And then they're vastly underreported because we know a lot of people are testing using antigen testing because of a change in testing policy. And they're not, you know, you have to be a fairly good girl like myself to upload the positive antigen tests on the web.
Yeah, and I'd say a lot of people are avoiding antigen tests like the plague. So do you think this is wise?
So I think we're sort of... there's a number of issues that I have with it. One is still this thing about long COVID. So a lot of people, you know, very disabled with long COVID. It doesn't happen to everybody. It happens to some people. We don't understand it. We don't have a treatment for it. So a little bit of caution needed there. Can happen to kids as well. I think the other thing is that we're sort of in a halfway house at the moment. So we're trying to stop it spreading in hospitals. So, you know, when staff are positive, they're out. We're cohorting patients. We're trying to put in infection control procedures. And really, with the numbers as high as they are at the moment, it's just no longer workable to try and do that with our current infrastructure.
So I see, and I think it's in the head of the Sláinte or Saolta group in the west of Ireland is saying that maybe the calculus of risk is changing as regards in hospitals isolating people who have COVID, that maybe at this point, on balance, the easier thing to do is not to isolate them and you get more people treated.
Certainly the more practical thing to do is not to isolate them. Now, the problem is that in hospital, well, in hospital, there are people who don't have a functioning immune system. So there are people who've been vaccinated, but they have, you know, hematological cancers, leukemias, lymphomas, their immune systems or organ transplants. No matter how many vaccines they take, their immune systems still don't work properly. So they are still ending up very sick and we need to think about protecting those people. So certainly you'd need to protect that patient cohort. I mean, we work in a very old infrastructure. We still have six-bedded wards, you know, shared toilets. You know, we're very cramped. ED is trolleys on corridors again. I think in that physical setting, it's just not possible to stop the spread. And trying to half do it with the kind of half measures that we have at the moment is very, very difficult.
Okay. So do we need to be honest with ourselves here?
Absolutely.
So
honesty is always the best policy. Honesty, okay. Adult conversation, sit down and be realistic. And then see what we do.
So the reality now is we're moving on. We're letting
Well, the reality is it's spreading hugely in the community. The numbers are really high. We've loads of staff out. We've loads of patients
coming in.
We can't stop it the way we're going at the moment. And it would be very difficult
but
to stop it anyway.
Would masks even stop it?
Masks would probably slow it a little bit or would slow it a little bit. So I have to say, you know, I did 6 months in total on COVID wards looking after COVID patients in rooms, six-bedded wards with people coughing with COVID. And the only thing that kept me safe was my mask. Okay. And I didn't get it. So masks really work. They really, really work. And ventilation really works, which we haven't been doing
either. Is there any point in slowing it down at this stage?
Well, that's a really good question. And I suppose that's around if we're keeping staff out of hospitals while it's spreading, like, we may need to slow it a little bit for that reason, because it's got to the point where with staff absences, it's really difficult. We run an overstretched health system anyway. It's very difficult to run a hospital when you've so many staff out. So I think it's difficult, Brendan. It's not a simple question. There are simple answers around ventilation and things that we should be doing now for the next surge. And those are simple things and we're still not doing them.
OK, yeah. So we do need to have a conversation here, do we?
We need to have an adult, rational conversation. And we love, we're humans. We like sticking our head in the sand. But if you stick your head in the sand, you get sand in your ears and your eyes.
Right.
Don't do it.
Paul Hosford, you picked out the front page of the Sunday Indo, this Donnelly and Houlihan clash on COVID body as cases spiral.
Yeah, so this is the replacement for Neffit or Neffit Light, or I can't believe it's not Neffit, that has been mooted for a couple of months now. It was when the restrictions were lifted at the end of January, we were told that there was work being put into place on this replacement body that would, I suppose, just offer advice, offer kind of a guidance into the next phase. And we heard that phrase a lot, the next phase of this pandemic. And it certainly feels like we're into the next phase. On Wednesday, Leo Varadkar told us out in Blanchardstown that this group was imminent, that it would be in place in the next, I suppose, he kind of indicated the next couple of weeks. But the Sunday Independent today, Hugh O'Connell and Maeve Sheehan report that there's a bit of a butting of heads between Health Minister Stephen Donnelly and the outgoing Chief Medical Officer, Dr. Tony Houlihan, about the makeup of this group, what it would do, what powers it would have. And I suppose that's understandable, because if you think back to particularly the end of last year, as we were very uncertain about where we were. We were at high case numbers, but we were very vaccinated. There was questions over what restrictions would stay in place and for how long. There were some in government, particularly backbenchers within the government parties, who felt that there'd been something of an abdication of responsibility to Neffit, that Neffit was kind of driving the bus at times.
Okay. So at the moment, is the reality of where we're at then that there is no great urgency, or have the government kind of moved on as well? Like,
I wouldn't say moved on. There's still a very keen awareness, particularly as numbers in hospitals increase. But there has been a sense that other business or other priorities have come to the fore, and particularly when you look across the papers, then at the impacts of the war in Ukraine, are what they're going to do in Ireland. So there has been a kind of a reassessment. When you think, you know, if you think about, you know, I was in here a year ago, and all that was on the agenda was COVID. There was nothing else. It was all COVID, and it has definitely moved down the political priority list. I don't think anyone is under any illusions that it's gone. But I mean, if you take for example this COVID contingency fund that's there, the unspent €3 billion. The fact that we were talking about doling that out or kind of parceling that up, or using some of it for the response to Ukrainian refugees arriving in Ireland, I think that kind of says a lot about where the general sense is on this politically.
Right. I hope it stays fine for us. Professor Lisa Ryan, what do you think?
Well, I think COVID is definitely seems to be all around me, that's for sure. And, you know, I'm in UCD every day, and students are calling in sick, but very few masks are in evidence since we were told they didn't have to wear them anymore. So people don't seem, by that evidence, to be that worried. They're going around, and certainly with the good weather, students seem to be, you know, back being active again. I would say that, you know, one of the main arguments always seem to be about protecting our health system. And it does, you know, I'm the outside of this, but it does feel like we lurch from one crisis to the next. And, you know, if we didn't have COVID, we'd have the winter vomiting bug or something else, and there'd be still the same problems on the trolleys. So
yeah, it was in crisis long before COVID.
It was in crisis long before. So I think maybe we could be addressing, maybe we should turn away from just focusing on the COVID impact now, and just like look at it more structurally at the health system and what we can do to stop those trolley waits and all
you
the
see,
queues that
I,
are there.
I have this theory that COVID was very handy in a way, wasn't it? Because when health people and HSE people came on, they were never asked, well, how are you managing your hospitals? Where are the hospital management and all this? Why are some hospitals doing okay here and some aren't, in terms of trolleys and everything else? It was all, they came on and gave a litany of their problems, yes. And it was as if it was our problem a little bit. Bobby, do you think, are we okay? Are you happy about us just moving on with life now?
Well, I think there's always been a challenge of finding a balance on COVID between directing all our weapons at it and allowing people to get on with life. And I think there are two feelings out there in the public, as far as I can judge. One is a concern that COVID is on the rise again, but the other is a huge sense of relief that we can get on with doing the things that we weren't able to do, including going on holidays abroad and so on. And I think that there's a big difference between telling people now that they can't do some of the things that they've started doing, and on the other hand, telling them they should wear masks. I mean, for me, to give more clear-cut advice on wearing masks and allowing people to get on with what they're doing is quite different from restricting them from what they're doing. So, you know, I think we have very good...
I think there is clear-cut advice on masks, though. There is advice, for sure, isn't there?
Well, it could be more overt and clear, I think. Even making it compulsory on public transport again, you know, I would personally be open to that, but these are difficult balances to reach.
Yeah. Before we leave it, Cliona, you mentioned long COVID. Something I've noticed with a lot of people that I know is that they're kind of not right for a few weeks, and then they don't know, is this long COVID? Or, you know, people talk about they got a bit breathless, they're a bit tired for a while afterwards, that kind of thing. I wasn't really sick, right? But what I would have said is it's a dirty kind of thing in you, isn't it? It does feel slightly like you've been a bit poisoned, even though I didn't really have symptoms.
Absolutely. And there's a whole spectrum of things that people can have, and it can last different lengths of time. But it is a nasty infection. And, you know, I do research on COVID as well as other things. And it really affects your blood vessels, for example, your increased risk of having a heart attack or a stroke after you've had COVID. Even if you've had mild or asymptomatic COVID, it affects your blood-brain barrier. So some people find they have difficulty concentrating, difficulty remembering. And it can happen even to kids, as I was saying. I have friends whose kids are still on the sofa. So it's not a trivial infection. And there's so much that we don't understand about it. And yeah, absolutely. And, you know, some people are really disabled and not able to go back to work after having had COVID, or not able to go back to their sports or their family life as they would have had it. And so those aren't trivial things.
Okay, look, we leave that there, and we'll get on and talk about the other pressing issue of the day, which is Ukraine, Biden, war, etc. And if you put on your headphones there, I want to talk first to Ruth Diarmond. And Ruth is at the Department of War Studies at King's College London. She's a lecturer on Russian foreign and security policy, on US-Russia relations, and on European security. So, Ruth, you are qualified on all counts to tell us about this. Listen, where can I ask you first? In terms of militarily and strategy-wise and tactic-wise and all that, do you understand where we're at? The Russians had this much vaunted announcement that they were focusing now in the east of the country, and then they proceeded yesterday to bomb the north, the west and the south, I think. What's going on?
Well, I think there are a couple of things. Obviously, the you know, the announcement that... But basically, this was what they were planning to do all along. You know, it's a face-saving claim, I think, because they've done so very badly in a war that they expected to be quick and easy. Right? But also, you know, the announcement followed by the bombing in parts of the country they said they weren't interested in is stuff that we've seen them do before. I mean, they've called a number of times for kind of peace talks, and then while the peace talks have been going on, they've actually increased their bombing. I think also the attack on the west of Ukraine can maybe be seen as a warning sign, because Biden was in Poland at the time, and so this was, you know, a not very subtle hint, I think, in his direction. So there are all sorts of things going on, really.
Okay. Now, you wrote a piece in Prospect magazine, and you say that basically this is an error of historic proportions by the Russians. And, and I think you say that the Russians have lost this war already, in a sense.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, and I think it's true for a couple of reasons, particularly. The first one is because before the war, you know, even people who were following what was going on in the Russian armed forces fairly closely thought that the Russian armed forces was a, you know, a really impressive kind of fighting force. And I don't think anybody thinks that now. So the Russian government spent billions and billions of dollars reforming their armed forces for more than a decade. And it's been exposed as a, you know, a not very impressive armed forces with a whole load of problems. So that's an issue for them. But I think the other big kind of historic failure of this is that Putin said before the start of the war that what he wanted to do was to kind of reset the strategic map of Europe back to the 1990s, back to a period before NATO expansion. And actually, you know, he has got a reset of the strategic map of Europe, but not in the direction we wanted, you know. You know, be careful what you wish for, right? You know, NATO may well be expanding. It seems more cohesive than ever. The European Union is acting more in a more coordinated way on Russia than it's ever done before.
And Ukraine has come together as a country or a nation in a way that they never did before as well, haven't they?
Oh, absolutely. So, I mean, ever since the collapse of the Soviet Union 30 years ago, you know, Ukraine was always a divided country, and it doesn't really look that divided anymore. Right. I mean, obviously it's divided by the presence of Russian forces, but there seems to be more cohesion in Ukrainian society than before. And of course, Zelensky, President Zelensky was very unpopular before the war and now massively popular.
Yeah, so it's backfired on just about every level, so if you look at it that way. What about Biden's comments last night that Putin cannot remain in power, seemingly going off script?
He's done this before. He did it early on in his presidency when he said that Putin was a killer. I'm not sure it's that helpful, because at some stage, you know, everyone is going to have to sit down and talk to each other. And if the Russian government thinks that the American government is aiming to remove the president, aiming to remove Putin, that raises the stakes for the Russian government. And I think it means that they're going to be less likely to want to talk, perhaps.
Yeah. And I gather those comments are dangerous. Sorry, Ruth. I gather those comments are all over Russian state television and media as well.
Right, as you would expect, because it's kind of giving them what they want, in a sense. It makes it more like a war for their survival, which makes it easier to sell to their own population.
So where do you see all this going?
Well, I mean, that's the, I don't know, you know, million ruble question.
Yeah.
Not that will buy you very much these days. But,
exactly, yeah.
it's impossible to say at this stage. I mean, I think we can see where it isn't going, and where it isn't going is in Russia's favour, right? You know, okay. Russia is not, I think, going to get what it wants out of this.
But do I sense it's, you wouldn't think it's going for a quick solution or resolution either? No.
No, that's just not possible. I think not with this kind of conflict. Ukraine doesn't have the capacity to win quickly, and I'm not sure Russia has the capacity to win at all.
Yeah, yeah. And you see, Ukraine do seem to have moved into a space now where they now want to win a war as against just defending their country. Would you get that impression?
Yeah, absolutely. And so it's, I think that's going to obviously going to make it slightly harder to for there to be a resolution quickly, because they want, I think, to take back the territory that Russia took from them 8 years ago. Certainly that's got to be at least part of the objective, I think. And, you know, because they're doing so much better than everyone except they themselves may be suspected, there's a kind of motivation to carry on and you know, to get back what was taken from them, I think.
Okay, Ruth Dearman from the Department of War Studies at King's College London, thanks very much for that.
Thank you.
Thanks, Ruth. Bobby, where should we start with Biden and that comment yesterday? That was a major gaffe, wasn't it?
Yes, I think it was definitely a mistake, and his officials have been rowing back on it. I mean, to be fair, he didn't say that Putin should be overthrown. He said in an exasperated way, for God's sake, this man can't remain in power. He clearly shouldn't have said it, but he said what a lot of people are thinking.
He's been calling him a butcher, I don't know, thug, all kinds of other words. If we heard Putin going on like this about Biden, we'd be saying the man is irrational, he's crazy, and he's ramping stuff up and everything.
Well, I'm not defending that particular remark that he made, but yeah. I think it has to be seen in context. I think it's the specific aspect implying that Putin can't stay that is causing the problem. Other adjectives to describe Putin are not that unreasonable. But I think given Putin's paranoia that he has convinced himself, notwithstanding the evidence of our eyes, that it's Russia that's under attack rather than Ukraine, it was definitely a mistake. And as I say, I'm not defending it, but to put it in context, Putin has said not only that the Ukrainian president should be got rid of, but the whole country of Ukraine should be got rid of. So yeah. I'm just putting that as... One of the downsides of Biden's remark is that it risks taking attention away from the really important thing, which is maintaining and stepping up the sanctions and our support for Ukraine and dealing with the terrible refugee situation. I think that's what remains really important.
Yeah. And do you see a diplomatic solution here?
Well, it used to be said that there were three possible solutions. The first was a quick military victory for Russia. I think that's off the table. So that leaves two possibilities. One is a long, long struggle in which many Ukrainians and Russians will die. And that would be very sad, indeed, and tragic. The third possibility is some sort of agreement. And one has to hope that there will be a diplomatic agreement. There are some elements in it that, you know, can be managed. I think the idea of Ukraine remaining militarily neutral, you know, it will probably be an element if there is a deal, and of course a Russian ceasefire and withdrawal. But there are, I think, three major difficulties. One is the territory that Russia has occupied, that is part of Ukraine. How are you going to deal with that? The second is the security guarantees that Ukraine would require, because it remains military neutral. It clearly is not going to accept the threat that Putin or his successor will walk in again tomorrow.
Yeah.
And then thirdly, I suppose there's the survival of Ukrainian democracy and independence in general, which Putin's main war aim was to get rid of that.
Basically.
Yes. Yeah. And clearly, Zelensky and his government cannot accept anything other than maintaining the independence and sovereignty of Ukraine. I mean, I know one of the Russian negotiators referred to a Swedish solution for Ukraine. And by that, he may have meant military neutrality. And that could perhaps be negotiated. But of course, the Swedish situation is that it's a free, independent, democratic country. And that's essentially what Ukraine is trying to be. So I think it's either a protracted struggle or a diplomatic solution. And all we can hope is that there will be a diplomatic solution. And maybe the reports that Putin is concentrating now on Donbass rather than the whole country, if we can believe them, is a small positive indication that a diplomatic solution is not as very far away as it might have been otherwise.
Okay, so it's a sliver of hope there. And of course, that's something that Putin could sell at home then to his audience, isn't it?
Well, yes, I think both sides have to be able to sell some sort of agreement. But the difference is that Putin controls the Russian media completely. So it shouldn't be a very big difficulty for him if he gets something.
So the win for him is an easy enough one. Paul Hosford, if this is going to go on for the long term, are our government prepared for long term, the sacrifices, the goodwill is going to start running out, isn't it? And other political priorities are going to start coming back.
Yeah, I guess that's one of the big questions about that social cohesion and how much that'll be tested and how much it can bend. Publicly and even privately, the government is saying very much that they are in this for the long term, that they're, you know, right now there's emergency planning, we're still on a crisis management footing, but they're looking at medium to long term solutions. That, you know, Pascal Donohue told us on Monday that money will not be the issue here, that, you know, whatever constraints there are, and there will be constraints to what we can and can't do, that money won't be it. So, you know, you look at the arms of the state, and I suppose there are questions, and there are legitimate questions about how quickly the state moves in crisis against how quickly it moves on a day-to-day level. I think we've seen that around COVID, the things that we were always told couldn't be done, that can be done. You know, but the reality is, and Leo Varadkar was very clear on this, even something like the Gormanston camp, which was mentioned on the front of the Sunday Business Post, that's essentially a tent city. One of the first conversations when there was a meeting of party leaders at the beginning, the outset of this Ukrainian crisis, was this idea that modular homes would be built and that we would do away with planning laws and we would lash up cities in record time. And that's just not possible. We don't have the ability to do things like that. It's just, you know, if we could move that quickly, we would have a long time ago. And Leo Varadkar was kind of clear on that on Wednesday. He said, look, if we could solve the housing crisis overnight, we would have, because, you know, aside from being the right thing to do, it would have been electorally very, very popular if they could build 50,000 homes tomorrow. They would have done
so. Cliona, I wonder, do we have the stomach to see tent cities of refugees? The kind of thing we're used to seeing on the borders of, you call them far off countries, but you know what I'm talking about. To see that under our own noses, to see people living like that.
Well, I would say we have the stomach to see it in the form of direct provision, which people are in for decades, in the form of homeless families being in homeless huts.
Direct provision, which is being resolved, and, you know, which people
very
were.
They did slowly.
They do have a roof over their heads.
They have a roof, but they don't have their own kitchen. They don't have their own privacy. They're sharing bedrooms with people that they have no control over. They have no family life. They have no private life. The housing crisis has huge impacts on health that I deal with on a day-to-day basis, huge impacts on physical health, huge impacts on mental health. And, you know, I think, again, we need to have an honest adult conversation about our, you know, we pay for it in many other ways. Why are we not putting the money and the effort that we put into mopping up the result of the homeless crisis into providing accommodation that gives people a dignity and a human life? You know, if it's a tent city for a week, that's one thing. But we don't have a good track record on doing exactly what Lisa was saying, which is the long-term sustainable things around housing, around health, around climate. And you know, we're brilliant in a crisis, absolutely fantastic, but we need to start thinking about longer-term planning. And I don't see a sign of this happening with the Ukrainians, and I don't have confidence. I have seen so many people whose health, who have died because of the housing crisis. And we're still in it, you know, without meaningful change.
Okay. But Paul, you wanted to come in there?
Yeah, I just think, I think Cliona kind of hit on it there. I think what we've really seen in the last 2 years is the result of running your country with long-running crises constantly, that when you get these external shocks, and nobody would suggest that the government, any government, is responsible for COVID-19 or war in Ukraine, but the capacity issues that we have come down to the fact that we just are living with these ongoing crises, that we're always in some kind of health or housing crisis, and that when you get those big once in a generation shocks, your capacity to deal with them is effectively zero.
Okay, but we seem to have, Lisa, don't we, a capacity to deal with the refugee situation so far. Everybody is clapping ourselves on the back for how we're doing on it.
Well, I think we do seem to think we're doing okay on it, because we've accepted to take in many more refugees than we have ever accepted to do so before. So I think we're clapping ourselves on the back for agreeing to do that.
Yeah.
And so far, you know, the people who have been taken in seem to be being, you know, taken in properly and going out into the community. I saw there was a nice picture somewhere in, of Lisdoun Varna community coming out to meet the Ukrainian ambassador, and that seems to be going very well. But I'd be with Cliona. Like, when I see the numbers that they're talking about, even like, yeah, you know, 40,000 by the end of the month, I just wonder, you know, we just don't have a good track record, is my impression.
Okay, but okay. From an economist perspective, can you think of any solution to this if we do end up with 40, 50, 100,000?
I'm not sure it's an economics question, but I am hopeful.
Well, economics is going to be a huge part of it.
It is going to be a huge thing.
Goodwill is all very well for now, but if people feel that there are millions that can suddenly be released to give all these people everything they need. And look, we had last week, like, the texts into the programme. I'm not saying they're right, but there are people thinking, hang on, I don't get my services that I'm entitled to. I don't get a house.
Well, I think, you know, it doesn't seem to be a question of money. You know, we have, I think, an extra $3 billion in corporation taxes that came in this year. So, you know, there should be enough money there. It's a question of putting the right systems in place.
Yeah.
The fact that we have 20,000 householders willing to take people in is a very good start, but I can't see that being a long-term solution. You know, that will be this immediate term, but it could buy us time in terms of taking people in, and then, you know, a lot of people will want to go back, of course, as well. But it'll take time for them to be able to go back, because they have to rebuild their country. But you can see that there will be a possibility to, you know, to build something then out of that.
Yeah. Bobby?
Brendan, I think if flying by the seat of our pants was an Olympic sport, we'd win it all the time. But I think it's fair to say that we've managed a few crises very well. I mean, for example, Brexit was going to, you know, completely upset the peace process in Northern Ireland. And against the odds or the predictions, we've managed to ensure no hard border. I think COVID, of course, mistakes were made, but by international comparisons, we've done really well. And on the refugees, it's another huge problem. But as you say, the public have offered more than 20,000 places. Most of the people who came in the first week or two were taken in by Ukrainian families that they knew already.
It seems to be, I'm not it saying seems to be, it's 80-20 initially. It was 80% of them had somewhere to go, and now
it's the other way around.
80% don't.
But there's, I think, 3,000 hotel rooms have been identified and so on. These are not ideal solutions, but I see there's a poll in today's...
But I just think, is any of it going to be enough if we get the numbers we're expecting?
Well, I think it depends on how long the war goes on at the scale that it's going on at the moment. I mean, if it either ends or is more under control and the west of Ukraine is not under constant bombardment, I think the flow of refugees will not be as
fast
as it has been.
And you see, you wonder, is that what it is? Are we kind of living in hope, Paul, that there aren't going to be as many as we think, or that this isn't going to go on as long as we think? Is that the kind of wishful thinking at the moment?
Yeah, I suppose, look, everybody hopes that this ends soon enough with some kind of peaceful solution. But yeah, there is that idea. Look, on a population basis, if 10 million people were to flee Ukraine into the EU, we would, by EU standards, be liable to take 2% of that. That's where the 200,000 figure comes from. But a lot of people in government are saying, look, we might not end up with 200,000 people coming here because they might not want to come here. A lot of people will end up in the likes of Poland or Romania, and they're far closer to Ukraine.
Poland are making it very clear at this stage, and I'm sure it'll start trickling into the other countries over there as well, that there's so much they can do, but they can't do it all. Okay, well, we're not going to solve that one here and now. We'll take a break. Professor Lisa Ryan, Paul Hosford, Professor Cliona Ní Chealaigh, and Bobby McDonagh staying with us.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
I should say there's a lot of support coming in for Joe Biden. I think people think that he should be allowed to say what he wants. But I think, yes, you can agree with him, but he's the president of America. So apparently he has to be careful what he says, because something he says is policy. Now, that's leadership in America. There's a good bit in the papers today about our own leadership. Paul, a few interviews with the new leader of the Labour Party, Ivana Bacik, today.
Yeah, she was crowned leader on Friday. She was the only nominee. She's already ruled out the merger with the Social Democrats, which is probably the biggest question that people had about it. I suppose this really comes back to the fact that if you look at those parties' individual polling or individual standings in the Dáil, you might not be overly impressed. But if you actually did combine them, you'd probably be up around 6 or 7% of support. You'd be around, you know, you'd be at 13 TDs and a handful of senators. And that might just be the natural level for a centre-left party in Ireland.
In reality, that's not the conversation going on about Ivana Bacic. The conversation going on about Ivana Bacic, for right or for wrong, is whether she is in touch or out of touch, isn't it?
Yeah, and I suppose, look, this is a question for all politicians to be seen to be in or out of touch. And we saw the row between Leo Varadkar and Michael Healy-Rae about who was more or less in touch with the public. Ivana Bacic was a senator for 14 years. She's been a TD for the last year. She's, you know, she took 30% of the first preference in Dublin Bay South last year. She's obviously in touch with some parts of the public. The one issue that I suppose Labour will find is that in the hours and the days after Alan Kelly was heaved out of his role as Labour leader, one of the big things, one of the major spinning factors was that it was about polling, that it was about, you know, low polling. It was about the fact that the party couldn't get any traction. And effectively what that's done is it's made Ivana Bacic a hostage to fortune for every opinion poll from next week. Okay. Because we'll all be looking at it saying, where are Labour? Why can't Ivana get the same? So if she doesn't get the same bounce, the questions are going to start to be asked. And you know, she probably has a much easier time in terms of, you know, the next couple of years. And you've got a natural kind of, you've got natural milestones there because you've got the local elections in 2024 and presumably you've got an election in 2025 if the government goes the distance. So you've got a better yardstick to measure her against. Alan Kelly never got a full election to be tested as leader. So it's an interesting one, but I suppose that the question for me comes back to whether or not there is that, where the ceiling now is for the Irish Labour Party, whether or not it is, you know, where it was in the days of Dick Spring or even Eamon Gilmore in 2011, or if it's just that natural where, you know, you have to combine them and the Social Democrats to actually get a measure of support for that kind of politics.
Okay, and of course the elephant in the room there being Sinn Féin, and that's in the Business Post. We should say Michael Brennan has that Bacic rules out joining Alliance ahead of next general election. Lisa, you were looking at Justine McCarthy has an interview in the Sunday Times with Ivana Bacic. I see Shane Ross is saying that she is overly focused on, I think, what he called wealthy people's worries.
Well, I think Ivana Bacic has a very long track record in social policies, for sure. She's always shown, you know, a lot of courage from her own student days when she had the student union and gave out abortion information that, you know, was illegal and, you know, suffered a personal cost as a result of that with court cases. So I think, you know, there's no doubting at all the track record there. And I think it's great that now she has come to leadership and she's able to lead her party. I suppose there will be questions then, you know, because she has the profile of, you know, urban middle class South Dublin, you know, how, you know, what are her economic policies? How can she come back to that other Labour roots, which is more the economic policies and workers' rights? And there's no doubting that she believes in all of those, but whether people will identify her with having them is another question. Yeah. So that would be the tricky part.
Bobby, is she going to win those young voters back from Sinn Féin?
Well, I think the Labour Party has made a great contribution in Ireland and we need a strong Labour Party. But I think you put your finger, Brendan, on the question there. She's going to have to appeal to young people. And I think it's not really fair for anybody to be making judgments today on whether she's in or out of touch. It's up to her what she does tomorrow and she has an opportunity to get in touch.
Yeah, and she's certainly progressive, which young people were told do like. Yeah.
And if she wants to get in touch with young people, apart from her policies, she's going to need to manage social media. She's going to need to manage the young people who get their information and their views are informed not by mainstream radio or television or newspapers, by social media. And if I were she, I would make that almost a number one priority for Labour Party to become proactive in social media.
Interesting. Okay. Mm. All right. Let's bounce along to energy and something that's probably affecting us all a lot more than who the leader of the Labour Party is at the moment. So, Lisa, if we start with the John Drennan in the Mail on Sunday, calls mount over VAT cut as fuel prices hit new high. And we heard yesterday that there was some progress made on getting a VAT cut. This story is saying, though, that the government currently getting more VAT than it used to be from petrol.
Yes, that's right, because VAT is estimated as a percentage of the current price. So as the price goes up, even if your percentage stays the same, it's not that the government have changed how much they're levying on it, but, you know, 13% of 50 is less than 13% of 100. So they are, and so this, I think this article lays out quite clearly in the table, you know, that this time last year, VAT was about 27 cents on a litre of unleaded petrol, and now it's 35 cents on a litre. And that's just percentage. And they haven't been able to do anything about that because there are rules in Europe about lowering your VAT levels. And we do have a lower VAT level than anywhere else in Europe. We charge about 13%, whereas the rest of Europe's at 23%. So in that sense, we do get a little bit way lightly with it, lightly being a relative term at the moment. So there is discussions going on in Europe about whether they can reduce that again to 9%. But the worry is if they get a derogation temporarily to reduce it, because a lot of countries will be doing that, that afterwards they'll have to go back up to the 23%. Yeah. And the Irish government wants to secure that 13%. So that's what the discussion has been going
on. So in terms of how do you see our reality in terms of what we're going to be paying for fuel over the next while? Is this only going in one direction?
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, energy prices have gone up. They are going to stay up. I'm not sure that they will continue to rise much higher, but they won't be dropping. And so this is really a supply issue. It's a supply crunch that we have right now, where our supply has been disrupted. You know, 25% of oil in Europe comes from Russian crude oil, and that has been disrupted completely. So when you have, you know, less supply and demand doesn't change, then of course you have higher prices. So markets are very high at the moment. And the other thing we have to remember is that our demand has actually increased, if anything, because we're coming out of COVID. Everybody had reduced their use of oil during COVID. In fact, oil prices went negative in 2020. So a lot of production dropped a little bit from OPEC producing countries. So the oil producing countries would have reduced their production during that time, and they're only been increasing it over the last year. So it's this storm of, you know, our demand has been increasing as our economic growth is starting to take off again, whereas our supply is now disrupted, and so that will drive prices up. So I don't know, I could get into policies now again, but there's a lot of pressure on governments now to look at how can you reduce those fuel prices. And, you know, that is very understandable, but at the end of the day we have to reduce our demand as well. If you don't shift your demand in response to a lowering of supply, then prices are going to remain high. And the other problem is
We're getting dangerously close here now, which people don't like, is to you telling people that they need to maybe just be a bit more careful about turning on the lights and turning on the heat and all that kind of thing.
Yeah, and I mean, some ministers have, you know, made that mistake a couple of weeks ago, and it sounds very paternalistic, but it shouldn't be perceived that way. If you think, we can think of this on a community level like we did with COVID. You know, look, what can we do to provide advice to people on how is the best way for them to reduce their fuel use? And it's not about trying to save the country. It's about how can I reduce my own fuel bill in the quickest way possible? And that is to drive a little bit slower. I mean, internationally, the International Energy Agency produced it last week, a 10-point plan for how people can reduce their oil consumption. And that's mainly using reducing their transport fuel. And it isn't about trying to preach to people, you know, don't drive, but it is about helping people, giving them the information, how do they use most fuel and how can they reduce it quicker. Demand response is always going to be our quickest response to a supply shock like that.
Okay.
And so it shouldn't be...
Because what people want to hear is that the government is going to subsidise fuel and the government is going to give them money to offset it and everything.
The problem with giving money is that we're facing rising inflation, and giving people money to assist with rising fuel prices just is, you know, pushing inflation on. It's increasing. It's giving more money to Putin, if you want, as well, because we're not trying to address our use of how we use that fuel. We're just helping people to pay for it. So I think what we need to do is, people are using fuel in different ways. Some parts of the country, they have no choice. They have to, you know, there's no public transport. There are vulnerable groups who are really struggling as well. So we need to, there's no doubt that we need to help the population, but we need to target it. Giving everybody, you know, cash in hand is not going to be the most effective way to do it.
Okay, so can I ask you one more thing then about our broader, if you want to call it, fuel security? So I suppose our basic understanding of it is that we can't import LNG in here. Our fuel doesn't come from Russia, it's coming from Norway and Scotland, but that could go back into a European central fund in a way, and that we could run into problems there if that happens.
Yeah, so, you know, we're in a better position than many countries in Europe that we don't get our gas directly from Russia. If you think of Germany, they get 80% of their gas comes from directly from Russia. Ours comes from a third from the CARB, so from domestic source, and then the rest comes via the UK, and it's Norway and the North Sea. But the problem is that, so that's just security of physical supply. We're still facing the same international markets in terms of buying that gas. You know, so, yeah. You know, we still face high prices, whether it comes from CARB, from Russia or from elsewhere. We're still facing the same high prices. What you're referring to there is the physical security issue. It's true that if gas becomes very tight in Europe, there will probably be some kind of arrangement between countries where they might divert some of that Norwegian gas, for example, to countries in Europe that are much more vulnerable to Russian gas supply, in which case, yeah, that will affect us. And it'll be mainly in the form of pushing prices up further higher for us.
Okay. Do you see fuel rationing happening?
I wasn't alive for the last fuel rationing, and it seems that this is very much a last step. I think the government would be very reluctant to do that. It would affect industry terribly and would be very bad for our international kind of competitiveness picture and how we're perceived by, you know, the international kind of community and businesses here. So I think they will really be very reluctant to do it. I think there's a better chance that they will fast track renewables. So, you know, our best option is to reduce our demand for that oil and gas, and then also to shift to non-fossil fuels.
Paul, you wouldn't like to be the government minister who comes on trying to tell people that, would you?
Well, no, I think one government minister already suggested that people drive slower and got roasted for that. So I definitely wouldn't want to be selling that. I think there's a really interesting point here, and I think Lisa kind of touched on it here, is this idea of where our fuel comes from. And, you know, the Russian war in Ukraine has obviously put a spotlight on that, but, you know, at the moment, we do import oil from countries that have less than glowing human rights records. And Pascal Donoghue, I spoke to him in London over Paddy's Day, and he was kind of saying that, yeah, we have to advance the cause, and we have to advance the cause of human rights. And this is one of those pushes that really shows why we need to become a renewable energy superpower. But then you see the front page of the Business Post, where Daniel Murray and Larkin and Allen have a story that says that the renewable industry says that we're not getting to the 2030 targets. We're just not going to hit them. And I was here with you before Christmas when the carbon budgets were announced, and I said, look, you know, the government has these big, ambitious plans for offshore wind energy that we have to hit by 2030. But 2030 is fast approaching. We're now 6 months further on, and the industry is saying we're not getting there. We're not going to hit
those
targets.
Does anyone believe we're going to hit our targets by 2030, Lisa?
It depends which targets we're talking about.
Yeah.
But
In terms of renewables,
I think that's the one that we're most likely to get, actually, too, is the renewable electricity.
Yeah,
in terms, I think it's much more difficult to hit the transport and agriculture targets, put it that way.
Yeah.
Whereas renewable, like, there are things laid out in the front page of the Business Post, and there's more detail inside. But they lay out things that, they are practical things that can be achieved. They're much easier than, you know, trying to change everybody's behaviour in society. These are things like, you know, fix the planning process, build a port, you know, build the cables to bring the thing onshore. So they are things that are fixable, that you can throw resources at, and they can get fixed. And I think it's really a question of doing that. So, yeah, I would be more hopeful, actually, than in many other areas.
So there's another thing we have to throw resources at.
There's another thing that we have
Lucky we have all these resources to be throwing around.
Well, we shouldn't forget that we, you know, people are cynical, but we are world leaders, actually, in wind energy, you know, and having 43% of our electricity coming from wind, on average, is nearly the highest in the world. Yeah.
It's not much.
Yeah, I mean, we have times in the week when we have 70% coming on, which is technically very difficult. It's not just a question of the wind blowing, it's also a question of the type of electricity produced, a little bit different to fossil fuels. Electricity, it's non-synchronous anyway, so we are, you know, we have very good technical capability there, but we do really need to get things going in terms of that infrastructure that needs to be put in place for offshore wind and eventually the hydrogen economy after that, hopefully.
Okay, all right, we'll take a break. Professor Lisa Ryan, Paul Hosford, Professor Cliona Kellig, and Bobby McDonough staying with us.
Text 51551. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Welcome back, Professor Lisa Ryan, Paul Hosford, Professor Cliona Kellig, and Bobby McDonough still with us. And on a different note entirely, Bobby McDonough, you want to make an impassioned plea for understanding for the royal family. Eilish O'Hanlon in the Sunday Indo being very mean about them today. She said watching Charles and Camilla was like watching Pathé news footage from the 40s. You think it was a good visit?
Yes, I think it was a good visit. Look, I'm not being critical of Elish Johanan, but she is a little bit, if you like, negative. She talked about Prince Charles's clumsy playing of the Bowron. You know, I think that it was a very well managed visit, and I would be the first person to criticise Brexit and the unnecessary form of Brexit and the messing around with the Northern Ireland Protocol and some of the other things that the Johnson government is responsible for. But the relationship between Britain and Ireland is profoundly important, both for trade and culture, because of the Northern Ireland peace process, and above all because British and Irish people get on so well, the huge Irish community in Britain and the growing British community here, with more people now moving from Britain to Ireland every year than the opposite direction.
Isn't it kind of funny that when as William and Kate have been down in other colonies, if you will, and they've been getting a lot of grief about the past and history and everything else, and to the point of awkwardness in Jamaica, you'd say, and that the royals come over here, and I think there is probably, I'd be killed for saying this now, but there is a more of a fondness to them, and that we have worked through those issues in a way, have we?
Well, I think the Queen and Prince Charles have made a big contribution to British-Irish relations. I think the difference between Ireland and Jamaica is that Ireland has been a free, independent country for 100 years.
Yeah.
And some people said, when I was the ambassador in London in the run-up to the Queen's visit, you know, is this not difficult for Ireland, and is the UK, you know, taking over Ireland again in some way? But it's the exact opposite. Ireland is a free, independent country, and there is no greater expression of one's sovereignty than to have a state visit from somebody from another country.
But we're looking them directly
absolutely
in the eye as against
and they accept
our
that, and we're equals. Yeah. And I have to take off my hat to Prince Charles and Camilla. They came to the Irish Embassy in London when I was there. I think it was the first royal visit to the embassy. They spent more than 2 hours meeting members of the Irish community. Prince Charles said that every time he's been with Irish people, he comes away with his spirits lifted. So I think the visit was excellent and very well managed. And
Eilish makes a broader point there, which is that the Queen and the fondness and respect for her is what's holding it together at the moment. And you'd worry when she's gone. I think she probably has a point there. Cliona Ní Chealaigh, people might not know this, but you grew up in the diplomatic world.
Yeah, my dad was an ambassador and was Bobby's predecessor in London. So I have a secret past as a diplomatic brat.
Right, and a fondness for the royal family, does that come with the territory then? Oh my God, no.
I'd say a pity for them.
Really?
Why? I think it's a very difficult life to lead. You know, they're under scrutiny all the time and it's not a very natural, normal life. And they have that whole English public school, no emotions thing. I feel kind of sorry for them. I think, as Bobby said, it's easier to feel sorry.
You're on the kind of Harry and Meghan side of things, that it's a life sentence.
Yeah, I suppose so. I mean, I think it's lovely, you know, they're not our king and queen. So, yeah, grand, come on over. And, you know, we're in the EU where we have equal status to the UK. I think I'm glad we're independent. I wouldn't like Boris to be our prime minister.
Yeah, absolutely.
So thank you to
isn't it nice, though, that we've come to a place
it's
now
lovely
where we pity the royal family.
Pity them, exactly.
that is true independence, I think. Lisa, before we go, the Oscars on tonight, we'll be talking a little bit about it in a while. You have picked a story in the Mail on Sunday about the Oscar stars having Botox into their feet.
Well, it caught my eye and I thought that was quite funny. But this is basically a talk of, you know, women haven't had to wear high heels for a few years now. And they were talking about going to the Oscars and squeezing themselves into very high heel shoes. And it's like going for a 3-hour hike, apparently, when you're at the Oscars, because you have to do so many posing and walking up and down red carpets. So it's excruciating. And I had my first, I think, post-COVID like event where I was at a conference last week.
Yeah.
And I had my high heels out and I thought to myself, but then I couldn't do it, you know. So when I read this article, I thought, I'm not the only one here.
That's what you were missing.
I just needed some Botox, actually. So this is what they're doing.
Feet, yeah. Are you back in the high heels, Cliona?
3,000.
I wasn't in them before COVID. I'm definitely not going to start them now.
Okay. The other issue is whether the Irish nominees will be described as British in the British media. Because there's a piece in The Independent, again, about how Simone Rocha has to tell so many people that she's an Irish designer, not a British designer. And we had the case of Rachel Blackmore during the week, who was nominated as the Briton of the Year on GB News. I think it's well intended, but I think there is a high level of ignorance in Britain about Ireland. I don't use
it's
that
just
as a,
still, yeah?
Yes, absolutely. Okay. I don't use ignorance as a term of abuse, just as a technical description, but many people don't realise that Ireland is an independent country or that we have the Euro.
Okay, so for all our talk there about how we can stand toe-to-toe with the royal family as another independent nation, some people in England haven't realised it yet.
We don't need their approval.
Okay, we don't. Okay, that's that's all we've time for today. Thanks to my panel, Professor Lisa Ryan, Paul Hosford, Professor Cliona Ní Chealaigh and Bobby McDonagh. And now we'll go to the newsroom and Eileen Dunn.